And welcome to NOLA History Guy Podcast. We're going to do a snippet today, and snippets are inspired by my friend Emma Fick and her book, Snippets of New Orleans. And one of the one-page snippets that Emma drew and talks about in her book is St. Augustine Catholic Church in Faubourg-Tremé. So we're going to do a short snippet pod today and talk about St. Augustine, just briefly. Now, I'm not going to deep dive too much, but just a little overview to go to follow up on the bit that Emma presents in her book. Now, in New Orleans, there are three St. Augustines. There's the parish in Tremé, which is the first one. There's also an Episcopal parish out in the Metries in Metairie, and then there's the high school in the sixth ward on AP Turo Boulevard, formerly when I was at the rival school. Brother Martin High School, formerly London Avenue, and that, of course, is the home of the St. Augustine Purple Knights, which were a big rival in my school, but that's a story for another day. Today, we're going to talk about the Catholic parish in the Tremé neighborhood. We'll give you some background on Tremé, talk about the Creoles of color, the main ethnic group that lived in Faubourg-Tremé, in particular in the antebellum years, talk about what they did to form the parish of St. Augustine and how that Catholic parish came about, how they built the church that is there, and then the church today, St. Augustine Parish today. And then there's a monument on the side of St. Augustine Parish. It's known as the Tomb of the Unknown Slave, and we're going to talk about that monument briefly as well. So first things first, let's talk, give a little bit of background on the Tremé neighborhood. Now, the Tremé neighborhood is north of the Vieux-Carré, or the French Quarter. So you've got the French Quarter runs from Canal Street on the western side to Esplanade on the eastern side, bounded by the Mississippi River on the south, and then Rampart Street, which really was a set of ramparts and forts, you know, protective area at the north. And then above, just north of Rampart Street, going out, that was basically out of town or outside town at that point. And there was a small church that was built there to go along with St. Louis Cemetery Number 1 as a mortuary chapel outside the city limits. Well, of course, the city continued to grow, and that growth became the next neighborhood. Well, there's actually two neighborhoods there. You growth to the east of the city was Faubourg Marigny and the Marigny Plantation, and then to the north of the city, the Moran Plantation, which was purchased in 1792 by a man named Claude Tremé. Now, Tremé wasn't really interested in operating the plantation and, you know, being a planter and that sort of thing. He was a land speculator and developer who then proceeded to subdivide the plantation. And one of the reasons for that was because one of the big plans that the Spanish colony had for that area was to build a navigation canal. And in 1795, the French Creoles of the city, basically the folks that lived in the French Quarter, working along with the Spanish colonial government, built a canal connecting the French Quarter and Lake Pontchartrain. Now, that canal was named after Baron Carondelet, the Spanish colonial governor. The idea was to build a canal that started with a turning basin just north of the city. In other words, just north of Rampart Street. And this is, in fact, the street that runs in front of that turning basin became known as Basin Street, right? So you get the idea. That's where that comes from. So the Creoles build a canal that starts, dig out a turning basin right there just north of the city. And to give it another landmark or to focus specifically where that turning basin was, just north of the city and then just to the west of Congo Square or Place Congo, which still exists and is inside is inside Armstrong Park. So the Creoles build a basically a straight canal that goes north from there up to the head of Bayou St. John in what is now the Mid-City neighborhood. And the current street Jefferson Davis Parkway runs east-west, more or less. You know how our directions are in New Orleans. It kind of runs uptown, downtown sort of thing. But the eastern beginning of the eastern end of Jeff Davis Parkway is the head of Bayou St. John. And so the Creoles dug this canal and ran it from the edge of the French Quarter up to the head of Bayou St. John, connecting the two together. And then boats could connect and go then up the bayou to Lake Pontchartrain. Now, once you're in Lake Pontchartrain, you can go out to the Gulf of Mexico via the Chefmenteur Pass or the Rigolets Pass into Lake Bourne, out to the rest of the world. So that navigation canal is a bypass for the Mississippi River, was a big deal. So the canal splits the Moran Plantation. So let's come back to Tremé a little bit. But again, Tremé didn't care. He was subdividing the land. He was selling it to developers. So this is the area basically that's, again, to the east of the canal and then just to the east of Congo Square. So Tremé starts selling that land off to individuals to build homes and to developers who build up the blocks. There was a lot of industry up in the... Obviously, industry popped up along the actual banks of the canal, so you could just drop your good, you know, pick up raw goods from the canal, drop your finished goods into boats and send it off from there. And then homes developed on either side of the canal from there, and that becomes the Tremé neighborhood. And the area itself was not considered, you know, it was kind of a commercial light industrial area because of the canal. So it wasn't like you had a whole bunch of people looking to build elegant homes. No other way to say it, you know, rich people just weren't buying into the Tremé neighborhood at that point. So by the 1810s, the city's growing. You know, you have folks moving from the French Quarter and expanding out. They're moving to Faubourg Marigny. They're moving towards Bayou St. John. But this area, you know, Tremé is still kind of this... just not appealing to folks with some money to build really, really nice places. So it becomes sort of that middle class neighborhood type of feel to it. And the big thing there is that because there wasn't a sense of exclusivity to the neighborhood, it grew in popularity with Creoles of color. Now, what's a Creole of color? Because you hear the word Creole is a hot mess when it comes to New Orleans, because different groups want to take ownership of it and it gets very complicated. But the easiest way to start it is to say that by the time New Orleans was part of the United States, which is 1803, now at that point, Creole was used to denote French and to a lesser degree Spanish families who were considered at that point to be native New Orleanians. Now remember, you know, New Orleans, we're going back to the trappers and the explorers, the Lemoyne brothers, 1718, and that whole bit. So by the 1790s and then going into the early 1800s, when we become part of the state, you know, we become a state of the United States, you have Creoles, or the people who are identifying as Creole are doing so to say, we're native, we're from here. And of course, the notable exception to that, and it's important to mention, is that there were really native Louisianans, native New Orleanians at that point, who were, of course, the Native American tribes that were here long before any of the European explorers. But the Creoles would basically identify themselves as such because they were French-speaking and they wanted to distinguish themselves from the Anglo-Irish Americans and the Germans that had come into the city over time. Now, the city had, in addition to these French-Spanish families, had a sizable population of what were known as gens de couleur libre, the free people of color. So, of course, you've got white folks who are Americans, if you will, or Irish and German immigrants. You have white folks who are French, Spanish, descend from the explorers, the Creoles, if you will. And then you've got this black population, essentially, that is a combination of free people who come, basically Afro-Caribbean folks who come to the city through the port, being, you know, New Orleans being a port city, attracting the people from other places, as well as freed slaves. Now, the enslaved are a different issue because, you know, the number of enslaved people who were actually freed, that's a small number compared to the actual free people of color. So the catch, though, is that those free black people who lived in New Orleans tended to identify more with people of French-Spanish heritage because they had come from Haiti. They had come from Spanish colonies in the Caribbean. They spoke French. They spoke Spanish. They identified more with that community so that they considered themselves Creoles as well when you make the distinction between, say, a Creole and an American. The problem was that the white Creoles didn't want black people identifying with them. I mean, we have that good bit of incredible amount of segregation and prejudice there. So the term over time, of course, starts as gens de couleur libre, free people of color, and that evolves over time into what we now refer to. We refer to the community as Creoles of color. And so that's the idea. And Treme becomes a residential opportunity for the Creoles of color. They buy into the neighborhood. They build homes in the Treme neighborhood. And technically, the geographic boundaries of Treme are going to be Rampart Street on the south, basically where the French Quarter leaves off, Canal Street on the west. But then you've got the Carondelet Canal coming in more like Orleans Avenue. So, you've got even there, it's kind of divided. Esplanade Avenue downriver on the east. And then to the north, what is now Broad Street is the northernmost extent to Treme. So that's kind of the breakdown of the square that is Treme, basically. Creoles of color take to this neighborhood. The property rates are affordable. They can build homes in the area. The Americans were staying more or less on the uptown side. White Creoles, the French Spanish descendants, were in the quarter or moving into Faubourg Marigny. So Treme became very, very popular with the Creoles of color. So moving now from the Louisiana Purchase, we start seeing this movement. Claude Treme is selling off the property to developers. Developers are then building the streets that, extending the streets of the French Quarter north, the quote-unquote north-south streets, and then connecting, building new streets to make city blocks on either side of the Carondelet Canal. That develops then for 30 years, basically, so that by the 1830s, the population of Creoles of color living in Faubourg Treme had grown to the point where the neighborhood wanted their own church. Now, keep in mind that the French-Spanish Creoles and then the gens de couleur libre, these folks are all pretty much Catholic. I mean, there's not a lot of the Protestants are going to be the Anglo, the English, the British, and the Germans, and even the Germans to a greater extent were Catholic as well. But basically, the Catholic community, the French-Spanish plus the black community were all Catholic at the time. So you've got these Creoles of color. You've got these folks that now live in Treme. They're living up past Rampart Street, and the only church they have to go to at this point, well, you've got the mortuary chapel, but who wants to go to church in a mortuary chapel, right? So they would walk back down into the quarter and go to church at the cathedral. And that was a bit of an effort, you know. It's like, and besides, you know, you're becoming a community. You're starting to gel as a neighborhood. And what does a neighborhood want in particular, you know, if you've got a sizable community of people of faith, they want their own church. So the Creoles of color by the 1830s are starting to talk about, we need our own church parish. So they come to the archdiocese, and around 1835 is when Father Anton Blanc becomes Bishop of New Orleans. And so he's the bishop that approves the formation of a parish in the Creoles of Color neighborhood, or in Faubourg Tremé. Now, Antoine Blanc is the last bishop of New Orleans and becomes the first archbishop of New Orleans. His first name is Antoine, but he is not to be confused with Father Antonio Sedella, who is the Père Antoine of all other New Orleans lore, who's an older, you know, he's a different story. He's a different guy. So, you know, you walk, you know, you've got Pirates Alley on one side of St. Louis Cathedral, and you've got Père Antoine Alley on the other side. That Père Antoine is Antonio Sedella. That's the Spanish guy who turns out he was part of the Inquisition. A whole nother story. Antoine Blanc is the last bishop, if you will, of New Orleans. He takes over the Diocese of New Orleans in 1831 and becomes Archbishop in 1850. So, excuse me, not 1831, 1835. So, I'm roughing it here on the dates, but because Antoine Blanc, because Bishop Blanc is the one that approved the formation of the church parish in Tremé, and he took over as bishop. He ascended to that to the Diocese of New Orleans in 1835. I'm going to tag the formation of St. Augustine Parish at 1835. Now, obviously, the folks in the neighborhood had been talking about that for years and everything, but, you know, let's just go ahead and say that if Blanc approved it, then it was around 1835, maybe 1836 or so. So you get yourself approval to become a church parish, then the next thing you need to do is figure out how to build a church. And that's going to be the next part of our story, but we're going to take a break for a moment. NOLA History Guy podcast is sponsored today by Elysian Fields Press, the publishers of Edward Branly's latest novel, Trusted Talents. Trusted Talents continues the story of Renard Alciator as he uses his talents, psychic abilities, to protect New Orleans from dark forces among the talented. You can buy Trusted Talents at local booksellers as well as Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Kobo. For signed copies of Trusted Talents, as well as for Edward Branly's other books, go to ElysianFieldsPress.com, ElysianFieldsPress, all one word, .com, to order. Okay, back to our story. So, somewhere around 1835, 1836, the Creoles of color get the approval from Bishop Blanc to form their own parish. So now they're working on the goal of building a church so they don't have to walk back down into the quarter. So by 1840, the neighborhood's putting together money and they're looking for a place in Tremé to purchase the land for the church and go from there. They look around and, you know, start talking to developers and people who own the land. And by that point, the Ursuline sisters owned the block that's basically at what was at the time the corner of St. Claude and Hospital Streets. So the neighborhood's talking to the nuns, and the nuns were willing to donate that block to what would become the new parish. The condition that the Ursuline sisters placed on the donation was that the neighborhood name the parish after St. Augustine of Hippo, who was one of the patrons of the Ursuline sisters. Well, the parish leaders agreed to that. That wasn't, you know, a big deal breaker on their part to get that block for the church. So they work it out. The land gets transferred over to the church parish, and construction begins on what is now the St. Augustine Church that we all know, see, and love, right there in Treme. The church construction is completed in the fall of 1842, and Bishop Blanc formally dedicates the church on October 9th of 1842. As the church building neared completion, the parish began to sell pews to families in the neighborhood. Now, at the time, this was a common method of raising funds. As a matter of fact, Protestant churches had been doing that already for a couple of hundred years, where, you know, if you go up in particular, like you go to some of the Episcopal churches and Presbyterian churches in the Northeast, you'll see different stalls. And there, basically, that was the family stall, right? And the wealthier families in a congregation would have the stalls closer to the sanctuary, and they would buy that and then pass that down in the family. Well, Catholics didn't do the whole stall design because they were a little more egalitarian than that. And, of course, just set up pews in the church so that, you know, just what we're pretty much used to in a lot of churches these days. So we had more open rows of pews. Now, of course, the Creoles of color are working class to middle class people, and some of them had financial means beyond that. So the Creoles of color, the families of the Treme neighborhood, began to buy up the pews. And white Catholics in the city became less comfortable with the idea of a quote-unquote, I always feel like on the podcast, if you saw me doing this, I'd be making air quotes because I'd be saying the idea of a colored church. I don't want you to think I use colored on a daily basis, but you guys know me, so you know that's not true. But you get the idea. They basically, this is 1840 time, basically 1840 antebellum times. White folks weren't terribly comfortable with black folks getting their own church and having their own, you know, basically having enough money to buy up the pews and this kind of thing. And then there was one other piece of the story that really upset them. But basically what happened was is that Catholics that lived in other parts of the city were starting to look at buying the pews inside St. Augustine Catholic to prevent the Creoles of color from, quote-unquote, taking over the church, as it were. So this competition began, and basically it was a price war, essentially, inside the church. And it's what's known in the history of the parish as the War of the Pews, where Creoles of color and white folks competed to buy up the space in the church interior. Now, the Creoles of color eventually won out. I mean, this wasn't a... You know, there were white folks that were upset about the black folks having their own parish and their own church, but this wasn't a big rebellion. You know, you were suppressing this big movement in Treme or something. But so essentially the Creoles of color, they won out in the War of the Pews because they bought up pews inside the church at a 3-to-1 ratio. And in addition to buying the pews off the center aisle, which, you know, if you think back, you know, if you've been into some of those churches, you know, Episcopal and Protestant churches with the stalls, they're all close to the center aisle, right? Close to the sanctuary, close to the center aisle. That's where the people with means and, you know, willing to buy these pews or buy those stalls, that's where they put their families after the purchase. In addition to that, though, the Creoles of color bought up, essentially reserving out the pews on the side aisles that ran, because, you know, you've got the main aisle, then you've got pews running on either side of the main aisle, stretching out from there, from the center, and then you had two side aisles on, you know, to break up the pews for access and that sort of thing. And then you had pews again that ran from the side aisle over to the edge of the church building. And in addition to buying up the center aisle pews for their families, the Creoles of color bought up the side aisle pews. And they designated a number of those pews as seating for enslaved Catholics. Yeah, that was a thing. This was the first in the U.S. that the enslaved were allowed to worship in a Catholic church alongside free people of the parish. So if you were enslaved and, say, living, you know, you were living, you were a house slave in for a white family in the French Quarter, you had permission, you could get permission from your master to then go to church at St. Augustine. Now, this is, you know, it's a big deal because this is 1842. It's still obviously slavery. We're only talking 25 years, though, until that becomes kind of we don't even want to go there, right? I don't want to say it becomes a moot point. It's still a big deal, but it's pretty, you know, the idea of allowing the enslaved to worship with you. You know, the history of slavery goes back for hundreds of years in North America, and this is kind of a 25-year drop in the bucket, but still it's important. There were enough Creoles of color to establish this policy, buy into this, and of course the Diocese of New Orleans at the time is allowing this to happen, so it's a thing. It's a big deal. So St. Augustine then opens for business, as it were, in October of 1842. The parish continues to grow. Treme grows. We go through the Civil War. The Southern Rebellion and New Orleans, you know, we didn't have the massive destruction that other Southern cities incurred during the rebellion. So the Creoles of color can, like the rest of the city, continue on during federal occupation. The parish pretty much runs, and the Treme neighborhood is the both the physical and spiritual nexus of the Creoles of color community in New Orleans, and that runs all the way up to the 1890s, but hits a major speed bump, frankly, of the Creole, the Creoles of color community's own doing, and that is Jim Crow segregation. That's a whole story for another time, but suffice to say for now, the black population, the Creoles of color and the overall black population of Treme drops off dramatically as Jim Crow segregation takes place, because now you've got these severe restrictions on property ownership by non-whites in the country, and of course that has an impact on Treme. Treme itself actually starts taking on a much more Sicilian flavor over time, because there's so many black families that leave the South as part of the Great Migration. The Sicilians who are coming in the late 1880s into the 1890s start buying up homes in the Treme neighborhood. So now you've got black folks that stay, you've got Sicilians that are moving in. The mix in the neighborhood changes over time, but one thing that doesn't change and is still true to this day is that St. Augustine Church is still a spiritual nexus of Faubourg Treme and the black community of New Orleans. It's only blocks from Congo Square, and Congo Square is arguably the spiritual nexus of the enslaved community and descendants of the enslaved in New Orleans. Over time, that role of St. Augustine as kind of that Catholic spiritual nexus and the overall connection of the neighborhood to the Creoles of color and the wider black community still held its ground. All the way up to Hurricane Katrina, and then Hurricane Katrina presented a bit of a sticking point or a problem. Sticking point's a bad description there. Of course, Katrina devastated the city, and one of the things that the Archdiocese of New Orleans began to do was to look at neighborhoods whose population had dropped off, the fact that they that the, well, let's say the Catholic Church really doesn't have the priests, the number, priests in numbers like it used to. So that became a problem. And there were decisions across the city from Uptown to Gentilly, just basically across the board, to start closing churches and then taking the parishes where the church had been closed and merging that with nearby parishes. A good example of that is out in Gentilly, where St. Francis Xavier Cabrini Church on Paris Avenue, that parish, Cabrini Parish, was merged with St. Raphael Parish, and then combined, also added into that mix, was the Newman Center at the University of New Orleans. And those three entities now have become Transfiguration of Our Lord Parish in Gentilly. And there was a move to do something similar in Treme, and in Treme, in Faubourg St. John, where take a couple of the historically black parishes, including St. Augustine, and merge them together. And that became a real problem for a lot of folks in New Orleans. There was a great deal of resistance to that, to the point where, taking a page from the Boston playbook, you know, there was a, you know, Boston, the Archdiocese of Boston was plagued with all sorts of financial problems relating to settling out clergy sex abuse cases, and they started selling off churches and property, merging parishes, and it got to the point where several parishes basically just occupied their churches night and day as a resistance movement to try to prevent this. The folks from St. Augustine called and tried to get folks who were helping rebuild the Treme neighborhood, and basically they occupied the church, and that kind of brought the archdiocese to the table, as it were, to negotiate a plan, or to work out a plan, to continue St. Augustine Parish as an entity. And the initial agreement was, okay, you're kind of on probation. You need to show us a plan. You need to show us how it's going to develop. You need to get your act together. And that was a legitimate concern, you know, because of the economic and population situation. But over time, the parish did develop an operational and development plan for St. Augustine Parish, so that by 2009, those plans were in place and the parish was moving forward, so that the Archdiocese of New Orleans took the parish off of probation. Now, as we said earlier, the original the street names for the block, the original location of St. Augustine Church, were the corner of Hospital Street, which was the north-south street, if you will, running up from the French Quarter, and St. Claude Street. Now, that's becomes what St. Claude Street actually, because, you know, if you keep going east, you keep going down into the Ninth Ward, that becomes St. Claude Avenue. So it was Hospital in St. Claude. But now, if you go to Google Maps, you're not going to find a corner of Hospital Street and St. Claude Street, because Hospital Street was later renamed to be Governor Nichols Street. And the section of St. Claude Avenue in Faubourg Treme has been renamed for the Venerable Henriette Delisle, who was the founder of the Sisters of the Holy Family. The Sisters of the Holy Family were an order of nuns who ministered to the Creoles of color community. And majority of the Sisters of the Holy Family were Creoles of color. They taught in the schools in Treme. Basically, they were the nuns who took care of that community. Henriette Delisle was the founder, and she's now known as the Venerable Henriette Delisle because she is on the path to be canonized as saint in the Catholic Church. So to mark that fact that she's now a venerable, and to mark, you know, to commemorate and mark the role of the Sisters of the Holy Family in the spiritual growth of Treme, that section of St. Claude Avenue is now known as Henriette Delisle Street. So if you look for St. Augustine Church on a map, you're going to find it at the corner of Governor Nichols and Henriette Delisle. One last piece for our snippet, because again, the stories, you can see just the stories that we've got. We're going to be able to keep going on the subject of St. Augustine and Treme for hours. But just to wrap this up, we'll talk about one more thing, and that's a sculpture that's next to the church that's known as the Tomb of the Unknown Slave. In 2004, a sculpture was added to the garden on the eastern side of St. Augustine Church, on the downriver side. And that sculpture basically is a cross, but it's a cross that's kind of laid down on its side so that the cross arms, it's a cavalry cross, you know, that style, but the arms of the cross, you know, one of the arms is touching the ground. So the base is on the ground and one of the arms is on the ground. So the cross is at an angle. The cross itself is made of iron chain links to symbolize the chains of the enslaved. The cross is on the ground. It's on an angle. You've got it. Well, there's a little picture of it, there's a little picture of it in Emma's drawing in her book, and then we'll post a bigger picture, of course, of the Tomb of the Unknown Slave on the show page, so you can visualize this completely. It's an incredibly moving display. It's an incredibly moving sculpture because in addition to this cross made of these big iron chains, and this is the kind of, you know, the kind of links that you'd think of like on an anchor chain, you know, this is big stuff. And then from there, attached to that are shackles, you know, chains that you would actually put on a human being to mark the plight and the struggle of the enslaved. It's one of those things that you it takes your breath away to experience it for the first time. Now, this was put up just before Hurricane Katrina in 2004. It's this big iron cross, and it's become known as the Tomb of the Unknown Slave. And that's, I think, a good name for it because, you know, we really have placed the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery as such a revered thing in the United States elevating, if you will, the plight of the enslaved to that level with a monument is, to me, that's a good thing, you know. It's not as such a tomb, of course, it's a sculpture as such, but it's likely that there are indeed graves of the enslaved in and around St. Augustine Church, mainly because if that was undeveloped land, the enslaved that lived in Treme or just outside, you know, because that area was just outside of town, no doubt that there are enslaved that were buried in or nearby the Tomb of the Unknown Slave. So it makes it a very powerful and fitting monument, in particular at the spiritual nexus of the Treme neighborhood and the Creoles of Color neighborhood. So that, to sum it up, that's a brief overview, just an expansion of Emma's drawing of St. Augustine in her book. This is really just a snippet of the story of St. Augustine Church. There's so many things here because that neighborhood and that church parish launched so many different careers and people and stories that we're going to be telling Treme stories forever. We'll come back for deeper dives into the parish in the neighborhood later, but now you've got a flavor for this. And when you come to New Orleans, or if you're next time you're down in that area, go up to Treme, you know, come above the quarter just a little bit and go have a look at St. Augustine Church. You won't regret it. It's an incredibly powerful location, incredibly spiritual location. So that's all we've got for today. Hope you enjoyed the pod, and we will see you next time on NOLA History Guy Podcast.